People's Tribune Radio is on the air. I'm your host, Mike Thornton. Today, our guest is 25-year veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency, Ralph McGeehee.
In my estimation, it's really a covert action agency that it does support or overthrow foreign governments. And in that capacity, it must propagandize not only people in those areas, but the people of the world, and primarily the American people. So I call it a covert action agency whose primary target audience for its lies is the American people.
That, plus our featured monthly commentary on People's Tribune Radio. People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publish the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo, as well as the book Moving Onward, From Racial Division to Class Unity by Nelson Peary and Brooke Hagerty. Stay tuned for contact and ordering information at the end of the program. Ralph McGeehee is a 25-year veteran agent of the CIA and author of the book Deadly Deceits. Let's talk, if we will, about how the agency goes about recruiting men such as yourself and others, because as I understand it, they're also in a major recruitment mode now, too, correct?
That's correct. Yes, they are. At that time, the agency was recruiting a lot of paramilitary officers. Probably they're doing some of that to this day, at this time. And they were looking for athletic young men, so they were sort of trolling amongst the rejects of the National Football League. I received a telegram saying, would you be interested in an important government job? Something like the State Department. I said, oh boy, this sounds great. This is when I got cut from the Packers. And I said, oh yes. And I was scheduled for an interview down at the Chicago courthouse. I lived in Chicago. And after the interview, I was sent down to Washington for further processing. I didn't know who I was being recruited for. All I was told is something like the State Department, and it wasn't really, for another, after I went down to Washington, I was assigned to a personnel pool, and we were down there and began to beginning rumors about what organization we'd be working for, but it wasn't until about 3 or 4 months after I was down there when I actually learned that it was the CIA.
Mr. McGeehee, you go to work for the agency, and in reading some of your biography, I mean, this was something that when it was presented to you what the agency was supposedly doing, fighting communism, at that time, I mean, you jumped into this kind of with both feet, correct?
Oh, yes. I was extremely honored to have been named to be at the forefront of the fight against communism. And, of course, the anti-religious and all that sort of thing. So I was very honored and committed to being part of this noble crusade. This was after the House Un-American Activities Committee, or while the House Committee, where it was holding hearings about communism in the United States. And everywhere you talked, where you talked to your professors, to your parents, to whatever, communism was a very big topic, and it was seen as a major threat, or the major threat, to our way of life. And to be selected to be part of this noble crusade against communism, which was just an immense honor. I served overseas 14 years. I was in Japan. I was in the Philippines. I was in Taiwan. I had 6 years in Thailand, and I had a 2-year tour in Vietnam. And between those overseas tours, which were 14 of my 25 years, I had tours in Washington, primarily in Langley, Virginia. So it was periods of going overseas for 2 or 3 years, coming back and working at Langley, and then going back overseas. In the first 17 years of my career, I remained a very committed cold warrior who is out to fight the evils of the communist demons, anti-religious demons. And then I was just in Thailand, I guess in my 17th or 18th year, when I was assigned to work against the Communist Party of Thailand, and it was here that my views and perspectives began to change completely.
Talk, if you will, about your experiences there.
Well, this came about in about my third tour overseas when I was sent to Thailand. And while there, I was chosen to run a project with the Thai National Police, which is a 50,000-man national police force. And the program there was to discover what the communists were doing. There are all sorts of incidents happening in the northeast part of Thailand to discover what they were doing and to report about it and to counter those activities. And I kind of looked at that as my mission impossible. Here I am, one person, one American, going to train the 50,000-man Thai National Police on how to... And the Thai police were virtually or basically unschooled patrolmen. And I was going to train them to be sophisticated intelligence officers and effective counterinsurgents. So I call this my mission impossible. What was happening, there are all sorts of incidents in the northeast and in the mountainous regions of Thailand that were happening and causing a lot of concern, because the war next door was in Laos and the war in Vietnam and Cambodia. So there was a lot of concern that was spreading into Thailand, and I was given this job. The agency at that time was reporting that there were approximately 2,500 members of the Communist Party in Thailand scattered throughout these mountainous and backwoods areas, and that they had no popular support within the lowland villagers. Well, I put together a team operation. Fortunately, I had an outstanding team, Thai team leader. It consisted of Thai police and some other government employees. And we went into, what we did is organized all the information on that particular area by village, by names of people in the village, and we formed an interrogation program and sent them in the village to find out what was going on, and we interviewed and interrogated almost everybody. And we weren't underway very long till we found out that what was happening is that the communists were organizing in the village, and they were organizing amongst the poor farmers, and most everybody was poor. And these people were becoming dedicated communists. And the agency were saying there are only 2,500 in the whole country, and we were finding that many in just a local one province, one of the 52 provinces of Thailand. My reports on this, and I could name, because of the specificity that we were developing, I could name the villages, I could name the villagers within them, I could tell what the villagers, the propaganda they had received, the training they had received, and all of this. And one of the people said, "Well, I'm a poor Thai farmer. I have no real hopes for my family or for myself. Best I can hope for my daughter is to become a prostitute in Bangkok, and my son will live my life." And the communists came in and said, "Well, you were just you're being subverted by this dictatorship, military dictatorship that is supported by the American people." Supported by the United States, and you have no prospects. Join the communist movement, and we'll change all that. And he said, when I looked at my life, it was exactly as they were saying it was. I said, "Well, of course, this is what is happening to me." And I joined the communist movement. My son became also joined. He became a guerrilla in the mountains, and we have dedicated our lives to a communist victory. And we went from village to village, and Thumbon, which is county, within that one province, we found the same thing everywhere. And I said at the end of about 6 months in that province, I could name 2,500 individuals by name in the lowland villages when the agency was saying they're only guerrillas and they're all up in the mountainous areas, and he said that they have no support within the lowland villages. So the agency's intelligence was completely erroneous. Had we gone to any of the other 51 provinces, we would have found much of the same story there. So the agency's intelligence was badly, badly undercalculating not only the numbers, but the organization of what was going on.
We're talking with Ralph McGeehy, 25-year veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency, also author of the book Deadly Deceits. Mr. McGeehy, you had a conversation about what you were just discussing with Bill Colby, who would later go on to be the head of Central Intelligence. Can you talk a little bit about that and what happened?
Yes, he came out to the province where we were working. He spent the day out there, and I set up a briefing with my team leader, myself, and I demonstrated all of the results. And he looked very, very distressed at all of this. And I had expected him. And we found out as we talked to these villagers and we exposed what they were doing and threatened them if they didn't, if they continued to be anti-government agitators, then we would take some action. They would, be arrested or whatever. So the movement just collapsed in that province. So I was very eagerly giving this talk to Colby, and he seemed very distressed, and the last thing he just said to me was, we always seem to be losing. Then he went away and went back to headquarters, and I expected, my career would zoom upward, and we were beating the communists all over the place, and that the project would be expanded all over the country. And instead, what happened is I was called down to the station and sent home, and the program was canceled. And this began for me, I guess, sort of my crusade that continues to this day. The agency did not want to hear any information that did not support policy. The policy being, in Thailand, the movement was not that strong. The problem was Vietnam, because the Thai communists had gone to school in Hoa Binh in North Vietnam and learned their organizational techniques in Hoa Binh, and they were just recreating in Thailand what had been done in Vietnam. And in Vietnam, which I later found out, the agency had started out reporting, there are only a few thousand villagers scattered, or people's communists scattered in various locations, and they have no support within the villagers. And we came to find out later that they had approximately 7 million organized supporters in the country. And this was sort of my crusade within the agency. After Tet 68 in Vietnam, said, "Boy, I hadn't quite made the turnaround. I still believe that we were a noble crusade against communism and that we should, win in Vietnam." So I volunteered to go to Vietnam, and it wasn't long when I was there, after I was there, that I discovered that the agency's reporting on Vietnam was just as bad on Vietnam as it was on Thailand, and the agency was tremendously resistant to reporting this sort of information, because in fact what it would say was saying was that the Thai communist movement, the Vietnamese communist movement, was a popular movement, and there's absolutely no way we could have won. Well, the agency was dedicated to a victory in Vietnam. It didn't want to hear that it had been fighting this false war all of these years and reporting this false information. So the information was buried and never, never received the light of day, and we went on fighting in Vietnam, killing Vietnamese. I think some 4 million Vietnamese died in the war, and at the same time, 60,000 Americans were killed in this unwinnable war, primarily because the CIA, which had tried to create this regime in Vietnam, was unwilling, unable, in whatever other way, to recognize the reality of Vietnam.
At the same time, we have people like Bill Colby who are skewing data, research and information and investigations that agents such as yourself were doing. I mean, Colby is also heading up the programs like the Phoenix Assassination Program and or others that are taking place in Vietnam, correct?
Yes, the Phoenix Program, by the count of the Phoenix organizer, had the last count that was available, they had killed about 35,000 or murdered 35,000 Vietnamese.
Mr. McGee, let me ask you a question, because as, of course, sir, I know you're aware, authors and journalists and reporters have put forth major stories regarding Central Intelligence's alleged involvement in drug trafficking. Can you share with our listeners what you think about those stories that have been put forth?
I think the agency itself does not profit from the drug trade. What it does do, though, is it sets up airlines, it sets up all sorts of forms of transportation in support of its covert operations, the war in Laos, the war in Vietnam, and all of these modes of transportation are utilized by the people that they're working with, either the Vietnamese or the Laotians or whatever, and they carry on those modes of conveyance drugs that go all over Southeast Asia that come into the United States. So, yes, indeed, there's no doubt about it. Even in CIA's Inspector General report, to some degree, alludes to this, that, yes, indeed, that drugs do come in via the mechanisms of the CIA's operations. The same thing happened in Afghanistan, of course. It happened in Vietnam, happened in Laos, happened in Burma. Happened in Central America with the Contras. So one of my concerns now is the war on drugs in Colombia. Wherever you have a paramilitary action, and really what the war on drugs is in Colombia is a paramilitary war against the Colombian communists. Whenever you have such a war, you're going to have airplanes flying, you're going to have trucks going, and the drugs will be shipped via these mechanisms. So the drug war on Colombia is going to in effect, explode the drug traffic in that country into the surrounding region. So it's if you want to call it a drug war, it's a war to ship drugs into the United States.
We are very, very close to a Vietnam-like experience in Colombia, aren't we?
Yes, we are. You have a there are two communist movements there. One, I believe, is about 15,000 who have been estimated, and another is about 35,000. Of course, these are just the numbers that the official U.S. government establishment puts forth. And like in Vietnam, that may be, rather than in the thousands, those numbers may be somewhat in the millions. So we are going to experience a tremendous, tremendous explosion of another Vietnam, if you will.
We're talking with Ralph McGee, he author of the book Deadly Deceits and 25-year veteran of the Central Intelligence Agency. It seems that CIA's main role is to act to some degree as the intellectual authors, if you will, of countering insurgency movements around the world. I mean, what does the agency really exist to do?
Well, in my estimation, it's really a covert action agency that it does support or overthrow foreign governments. And in that capacity, it must propagandize not only people in those areas, but the people of the world, and primarily the American people. So I call it a covert action agency whose primary target audience for its lies is the American people. The Vietnam War is so typical, where it sponsored many, many books. It was in academia, sponsoring all sorts of studies of Vietnam and Economicians, it just completely, and its media operations, of course, permeated every essence of our being, if you will, its anti-communist message in Vietnam, so that it really is a domestic disinformation operation, while it's an overseas covert action agency. Look at the official disseminations about Colombia. You know, we're not fighting communists there. We're fighting narco-terrorists. That's the word that is now being used for the Colombian communists. They're not narco-terrorists. We're not looking at the other side of the coin, which is that the Colombian military is the worst violator of the drugs export, much worse than the communist guerrillas. So, yes, indeed, we're seeing the same sort of thing there.
Mr. McGehee, you are involved with something called CIA Base.
What it is a computer database on CIA operations put together with a view to countering some of the views of the media about the CIA. I've gone through about 1,000 books and media of all sorts and extracted references to various operations of the agency. I broke them down to about 100 categories, and whenever I find something that fits in the category, I put it in into that category. And I've been doing this for close to 20 years, and it's it is searchable by subject heading, which might be terrorism, might be drugs, might be assassinations or covert action or whatever. And then there's two other subfields that can be searched. And I've been putting it together for these 20 years. And I distribute I sell the disk, actually, the database. To me, it is probably the only resource that is available where you can find out just about anything you want to know about CIA operations around the world.
I know that you also have an extensive website. If people wanted to get more information about CIA Base or your book Deadly Deceits or the website, how would they go about doing that?
Well, they could email me directly. That would be R. McGehee, R-M-C-G-E-H-E-E, that's all one word, lowercase, at igc.org. Or if they're just interested in seeing what's on the website, and I recommend that all college students who are looking for a career go to the website, because I think it'll be very, very informative about the CIA. The website is http://com/CIA Base, all one word, all in caps. So CIA Base is all in caps. Just a day or so ago, I wrote a short piece about the agency's role. Apparently, is to kill democracy, not only around the world, but primarily in the United States. And it has been so successful at this that I wonder in this piece whether it is too late already, since the agency has subverted the House and Senate committees that are to oversight the agency. And we cannot know its budget. We cannot know what it does, either domestically or overseas. So it's sort of a massive secret government that runs to a large degree what goes on in the world, while misinforming we Americans of what's happening.
Ralph McGehee, thank you for being with us on the program today. I really appreciate you taking the time to be with our audience today.
Thank you, Mike Thornton.
Thank you. This is People's Tribune Radio. And now, our featured monthly commentary from Sandy Reed of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America.
Have you ever thought about what it would be like to live on less than a dollar a day? As incredible as that may sound, 30% of the world today is doing just that. And as we all know, America is no longer immune. So the way that we're looking at this question of globalization, the WTO, the IMF, and all of it, is that really what it amounts to is that capital is now free to roam the world in search of cheap labor, since every worker today is competing against all the rest as never before. The inevitable result is the lowering of living standards for all and absolute poverty for most. And I wanted to just tell you an example of this. In a little factory town in Ohio, the workers there are working 7 days a week for minimum wage. They work so many hours they can't even see their kids. So the company is now opening a cafeteria on Sunday afternoon so the families can come and lunch with them. And I'm saying all this to make the point that the creation of the WTO and as well the growing protests surrounding it cannot be understood apart from this new reality where a whole new world is being created today as a result of the new electronic technology. And this technology, as we all know, is permanently replacing, downsizing more and more workers throughout the globe. And then alongside this, we see a whole new class of the richest people in the world. And this is really the class that the WTO aims to serve. The WTO is not just a good idea of some capitalists, but it really is a result of these changes taking place in the world. And the capitalists really have no choice, because the problem that they face today is that if workers can't work, they can't buy back the mountain of products the new technology is producing. And the system really begins to destroy itself. And as we know, this process is underway in every country of the globe. So to avoid the collapse of the system, they have to, and to maintain their profits and privilege, they have to devise new ways to expand the market. They have to have this, quote, free trade. And when all else fails, it means war. But I think the lesson from history is that when there were unjust laws, people had to fight against them. And not only fight against them, as the protests are doing, but really begin to develop people understanding intellectually through writing, speaking, newspapers, whatever, radio, where we really can begin to bring an understanding to people that a whole new world is possible today and we don't have to live like this. We in the League want to take the message out that cooperation, not competition, can unite people and create a whole new world. This is possible today, again, because of the new technology that can feed and clothe the world. We say if all this was created with competition, imagine how much more could be created with cooperation. What we're talking about is a cooperative, communal, communist society, not in the ideological sense of Russia or China or anything like that, but in the sense where people have the right to have the things that they need to exist. There's no other reason for society if you're not going to provide for people. And I'd just like to add that our doors are open to anyone who wants to contribute on any level.
People's Tribune Radio is produced by the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, who also publish the newspaper People's Tribune, Tribuno del Pueblo, as well as producing other audio material like Long Roads and Revolution, a conversation between Utah Phillips and Nelson Peary. If you're interested in the type of topics you hear on People's Tribune Radio, you may also be interested in Lerna's Speakers Bureau, providing speakers nationwide on topics of creating a cooperative society. You can get information about all of Lerna's activities by calling 1-800-691-6888. That number once again, 1-800-691-6888. My name is Mike Thornton. On behalf of the League of Revolutionaries for a New America, we invite you to join us next time for another edition of People's Tribune Radio.